Systematic Theology. Part 2, Anthropology. Having considered the doctrines which concern the nature of God and his relation to the world, we come now to those which concern man. His origin, nature, primitive state, probation, and apostasy. Which last subject includes the question as to the nature of sin, and the effects of Adam's first sin upon himself and upon his posterity. These subjects constitute the department of anthropology. Chapter 1. Origin of Man. Section 1. Scriptural Doctrine. The scriptural account of the origin of man is contained in Genesis 1:26-27, and God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. In Genesis 2:7, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And man became a living soul." Two things are included in this account. First, that man's body was formed by the immediate intervention of God. It did not grow, nor was it produced by any process of development. Secondly, the soul was derived from God. He breathed into man the breath of life, that is, that life which constituted him a man, a living creature bearing the image of God. Many have inferred from this language that the soul is an emanation from the divine essence. Particula spiritus divini in corpore inclusa. This idea was strenuously resisted by the Christian fathers and rejected by the Church as inconsistent with the nature of God. It assumes that the divine essence is capable of division, that his essence can be communicated without his attributes, and that it can be degraded as the souls of fallen men are degraded. CDELITZSCH's Biblical Psychology and T.N.T. Clark's Foreign Library, and Oberlin and Herzog's Encyclopedie, Article Geist der Menschen. Section 2. Anti-Scriptural Theories. Heathen Doctrine of Spontaneous Generation. The scriptural doctrine is opposed to the doctrine held by many of the ancients, that man is a spontaneous production of the earth. Many of them claim to be genies, autochthones, pterygena. The earth was assumed to be pregnant with the germs of all living organisms, which were quickened into life under favorable circumstances. Or it was regarded as instinct with a productive life to which is to be referred the origin of all the plants and animals living on its surface. To this primitive doctrine of antiquity, modern philosophy and science, in some of their forms, have returned. Those who deny the existence of a personal God, distinct from the world, must of course deny the doctrine of a creation ex nihilo and consequently of the creation of man. The theological view as to the origin of man, says Strauss, rejects the standpoint of natural philosophy and of science in general. These do not admit of the immediate intervention of divine causation. God created man, not as such, or, uatinus infinitus est, sed equitinus per elementum essentis telleris explicator. This is the view which the Greek and Roman philosophers, in a very crude form indeed, presented, and against which the fathers of the Christian Church earnestly contended, but which is now the unanimous judgment of natural science as well as of philosophy. 1. To the objection that the earth no longer spontaneously produces men and irrational animals, it is answered that many things happen formerly that do not happen in the present state of the world. To the still more obvious objection that an infant man must have perished without a mother's care, it is answered that the infant floated in the ocean of its birth, enveloped in a covering, until it reached the development of a child 2 years old. Or it is said that philosophy can only establish the general fact as to the way in which the human race originated, but cannot be required to explain all the details. Modern doctrine of spontaneous generation. Although Strauss greatly exaggerates when he says that men of science in our day are unanimous in supporting the doctrine of spontaneous generation, it is undoubtedly true that a large class of naturalists, especially on the continent of Europe, are in favor of that doctrine. Professor Huxley, in his Discourse on the Physical Basis of Life, lends to it the whole weight of his authority. He does not indeed expressly teach that dead matter becomes active without being subject to the influence of previous living matter. But his whole paper is designed to show that life is the result of the peculiar arrangement of the molecules of matter. His doctrine is that the matter of life is composed of ordinary matter, differing from it only in the manner in which its atoms are aggregated. Two of the properties of water, he says, may be properly said to result from the nature and disposition of its component molecules. I can find no intelligible ground for refusing to say that the properties of protoplasm result from the nature and disposition of its molecules. 3 inches his address before the British Association, he says that if he could look back far enough into the past, he should expect to see the evolution of living protoplasm from not living matter. And although that address is devoted to showing that spontaneous generation, or abiogenesis, as it is called, has never been proved, he says, I must carefully guard myself against the supposition that I intend to suggest that no such thing as abiogenesis has ever taken place in the past or ever will take place in the future. With organic chemistry, molecular physics, and physiology yet in their infancy, and every day making prodigious strides, I think it would be the height of presumption for any man to say that the conditions under which matter assumes the properties we call idle may not someday be artificially brought together. For all this supposes that life is the product of physical causes, that all that is requisite for its production is to bring together the necessary conditions. Mr. Mivart, while opposing Mr. Darwin's theory, not only maintains that the doctrine of evolution is far from any necessary opposition to the most orthodox theology, but adds that the same may be said of spontaneous generation. 5. As chemists have succeeded in producing urea, which is an animal product, he thinks it not unreasonable that they may produce a fish. But while there is a class of naturalists who maintain the doctrine of spontaneous generation, the great body even of those who are the most advanced admit that om vivum ex vivo, so far as science yet knows, is an established law of nature. To demonstrate this is the object of Professor Huxley's important address just referred to, delivered before the British Association in September, 1870. 200 years ago, he tells us, it was commonly taken for granted that the insects which made their appearance in decaying animal and vegetable substances were spontaneously produced. Redi, however, an Italian naturalist, about the middle of the 17th century, proved that if such decaying matter were protected by a piece of gauze admitting the air but excluding flies, no such insects made their appearance. Thus, the hypothesis that living matter always arises by the agency of pre-existing living matter took definite shape, and had henceforward a right to be considered and a claim to be refuted, in each particular case, before the production of living matter in any other way could be admitted by careful reasoners. 6. This conclusion has been more and more definitely settled by all the investigations and experiments which have been prosecuted from that day to this. It has been proved that even the infusorial animalcules, which the most powerful microscopes are necessary to detect, never make their appearance when all pre-existing living germs have been carefully excluded. These experiments, prosecuted on the very verge of nonentity, having for their subject matter things so minute as to render it doubtful whether they were anything or nothing, and still more uncertain whether they were living or dead, are reviewed in chronological order by Professor Huxley, and the conclusion to which they lead fully established. 7. This is confirmed by daily experience. Meat, vegetables, and fruits are preserved to the extent of hundreds of tons every year. The matters to be preserved are well boiled in a tin case provided with a small hole, and this hole is soldered up when all the air in the case has been replaced by steam. By this method they may be kept for years, without putrefying, fermenting, or getting moldy. Now this is not because oxygen is excluded, inasmuch as it is now proved that free oxygen is not necessary for either fermentation or putrefaction. It is not because the tins are exhausted of air, for vibrions and bacteria live, as Pasteur has shown, without air or free oxygen. It is not because the boiled meats or vegetables are not putrescible or fermentable, as those who have had the misfortune to be in a ship supplied with unskillfully closed tins well know. What is it, therefore, but the exclusion of germs? I think the abiogenists are bound to answer this question before they ask us to consider new experiments of precisely the same order. 8. But admitting that life is always derived from life, the question still remains, whether one kind of life may not give rise to life of a different kind? It was long supposed that parasites derive their life from the plant or animal in which they live, and what is more to the point, it is a matter of familiar experience that mere pressure on the skin will give rise to a corn which seems to have a life of its own, and that tumors are often developed in the body which acquire, as in the ease of cancer, the power of multiplication and reproduction. In the case of vaccination, also, a minute particle of matter is introduced under the skin. The result is a vesicle distended with vaccine matter in quantity 100 or 1,000-fold that which was originally inserted. Whence did it come? Professor Huxley tells us that it has been proved that the active element in the vaccine lymph is non-diffusible, and consists of minute particles not exceeding 1/20,000th of an inch in diameter, which are made visible in the lymph by the microscope. Similar experiments have proved that two of the most destructive of epizootic diseases, sheeppox and glanders, are also dependent for their existence and their propagation upon extremely small living solid particles, to which the title of microzymes is applied. The question, he says, arises whether these particles are the result of homogenesis, or of xenogenesis, that is, are they produced by pre-existing living particles of the same kind? Or, are they a modification of the tissues of the bodies in which they are found? The decision of this question has proved to be a matter of vast practical importance. Some years since, diseases attacked the grapevine and the silkworm in France, which threatened to destroy two of the most productive branches of industry in that country. The direct loss to France from the silkworm disease alone, in the course of 17 years, is estimated at $250 million. It was discovered that these diseases of the vine and worm, which were both infectious and contagious, were due to living organisms, by which they were propagated and extended. It became a matter of the last importance to determine whether these living particles propagated themselves, or whether they were produced by the morbid action of the plant or animal. M. Pasteur, the eminent naturalist, sent by the French government to investigate the matter, after laborious research decided that they were independent organisms propagating themselves and multiplying with astonishing rapidity. Guided by that theory, he has devised a method of extirpating the disease, which has proved to be completely successful wherever it has been properly carried out. 9. Professor Huxley closes his address by saying that he had invited his audience to follow him in an attempt to trace the path which has been followed by a scientific idea, in its slow progress from the position of a probable hypothesis to that of an established law of nature. Biogenesis, then, according to Huxley, is an established law of nature. 10. Professor Tyndall deals with the subject in his lecture delivered in September, 1870, on the scientific uses of the imagination. He says that the question concerning the origin of life is, whether it is due to a creative flat, at life B, or to a process of evolution. Was it potentially in matter from the beginning? Or, was it inserted at a later period? However the convictions here or there may be influence, he says, the process must be slow which commends the hypothesis of natural evolution to the public mind. For what are the core and essence of this hypothesis? Strip it naked, and you stand face to face with the notion that not alone the more ignoble forms of animalcular or animal life, not alone the nobler forms of the horse and lion, not alone the exquisite and wonderful mechanism of the human body, but that the human mind itself, emotion, intellect, will, and all their phenomena were once latent in a fiery cloud. Surely the mere statement of such a notion is more than a refutation. I do not think that any holder of the evolution hypothesis would say that I overstate it or overstrain it in any way. I merely strip it of all vagueness, and bring before you, unclothed and unvarnished, the notions by which it must stand or fall. Surely these notions represent an absurdity too monstrous to be entertained by any sane mind. 11. Professor Tyndall, however, as well as Professor Huxley, is on both sides of this question. Materialism, with its doctrine of spontaneous generation, is thus monstrous and absurd, only on the assumption that matter is matter. If you only spiritualize matter until it becomes mind, the absurdity disappears. And so do materialism, and spontaneous generation, and the whole array of scientific doctrines. If matter becomes mind, mind is God, and God is everything. Thus the monster pantheism swallows up science and its votaries. We do not forget that the naturalist, after spending his life in studying matter, comes to the conclusion that matter is nothing, that the supreme intelligence is the universe. 12. Thus it is that those who overstep the limits of human knowledge, or reject the control of primary truths, fall into the abyss of outer darkness. The way Professor Tyndall puts the matter is this: 13. These evolution notions are absurd, monstrous, and fit only for the intellectual gibbet in relation to the ideas concerning matter which were drilled into us when young. Spirit and matter have ever been presented to us in the rudest contrast. The one is all noble, the other is all vile. If instead of these perverted ideas of material and spirit, we come to regard them as equally worthy and equally wonderful. To consider them, in fact, as two opposite faces of the same great mystery, as different elements of what our mightiest spiritual teacher would call the eternal fact of the universe, then the case would be different. It would no longer be absurd, as Professor Tyndall seems to think, for mind to become matter or matter mind, or for the phenomena of the one to be produced by the forces of the other. The real distinction, in fact, between them would be done away. Without this total revolution, he says, of the notions now prevalent, the evolution hypothesis must stand condemned. But in many profoundly thoughtful minds such a revolution has already occurred. We have, then, the judgment of Professor Tyndall, one of the highest authorities in the scientific world, that if matter be what all the world believes it to be, materialism, spontaneous generation, and evolution, or development, are absurdities too monstrous to be entertained by any sane mind. We can cite his high authority as to another point. Suppose we give up everything. Admit that there is no real distinction between matter and mind. That all the phenomena of the universe, vital and mental included, may be referred to physical causes. That a free or spontaneous act is an absurdity. That there can be no intervention of a controlling mind or will in the affairs of men, no personal existence of man after death. Suppose we thus give up our morals and religion, all that ennobles man and dignifies his existence, what do we gain? According to Professor Tyndall, nothing. 14. The evolution hypothesis, he tells us, does not profess to solve the ultimate mystery of this universe. It leaves that mystery untouched. At bottom, it does nothing more than transpose the conception of life's origin to an indefinitely distant past. Even granting the nebula and its potential life, the question, "Hence came they?" would still remain to baffle and bewilder us. If we must admit the agency of will, caprice, as Professor Tyndall calls it, billions of ages in the past, why should it be unphilosophical to admit it now? It is very evident, therefore, that the admission of the primary truths of the reason truths which, in point of fact, all men do admit truths which concern even our sense perceptions, and involve the objective existence of the material world, necessitates the admission of mind, of God, of providence, and of immortality. Professor Tyndall being judge, materialism, spontaneous generation, the evolution of life, thought, feeling, and conscience out of matter, are absurdities too monstrous to be entertained by any sane mind, unless matter be spiritualized into mind, and then everything is God, and God is everything. Theories of development. Lamarck, a distinguished French naturalist, was the first of modern scientific men who adopted the theory that all vegetables and animals living on the earth, including man, are developed from certain original, simple germs. This doctrine was expounded in the Zoologie Philosophique, published in 1809. Lamarck admitted the existence of God, to whom he referred the existence of the matter of which the universe is composed. But God, having created matter with its properties, does nothing more. Life, organisms, and mind are all the product of unintelligent matter and its forces. All living matter is composed of cellular tissue, consisting of the aggregation of minute cells. These cells are not living in themselves, but are quickened into life by some ethereal fluid pervading space, such as heat and electricity. Life, therefore, according to this theory, originates in spontaneous generation. Life, living cells or tissues, having thus originated, all the diversified forms of the vegetable and animal kingdoms have been produced by the operation of natural causes. The higher, even the highest, being formed from the lowest by a long-continued process of development. The principles of Lamarck's theory are involved in the three following propositions. 1. That any considerable and permanent change in the circumstances in which a race of animals is placed superinduces in them a real change in their wants and requirements. 2. That this change in their wants necessitates new actions on their part to satisfy those wants, and that finally new habits are thus engendered. 3. That these new actions and habits necessitate a greater and more frequent use of particular organs already existing, which thus become strengthened and improved. Or the development of new organs when new wants require them. Or the neglect of the use of old organs, which may thus gradually decrease and finally disappear. 15. Vestiges of Creation. Some 30 years since a work appeared anonymously, entitled The Vestiges of Creation, in which the theory of Lamarck in essential features was reproduced. The writer agreed with his predecessor in admitting an original creation of matter, in referring the origin of life to physical causes, and in deriving all the general species and varieties of plants and animals by a process of natural development from a common source. These writers differ in the way in which they carry out their common views and as to the grounds which they urge in their support. The author of The Vestiges of Creation assumes the truth of the nebular hypothesis, and argues from analogy that as the complicated and ordered systems of the heavenly bodies are the result of physical laws acting on the original matter pervading space, it is reasonable to infer that the different orders of plants and animals have arisen in the same way. He refers to the gradation observed in the vegetable and animal kingdoms. The simpler everywhere proceeding the more complex, and the unity of plan being preserved throughout. He lays great stress also on the eftal development of the higher orders of animals. The human eftus, for example, assuming in succession the peculiarities of structure of the reptile, of the fish, of the bird, and of man. This is supposed to prove that man is only a more perfectly developed reptile, and that the orders of animals differ simply as to the stage they occupy in this unfolding series of life. As the same larva of the bee can be developed into a queen, a drone, or a worker, so the same living cell can be developed into a reptile, a fish, a bird, or a man. There are, however, the author admits, interruptions in the scale. Species suddenly appearing without due preparation. This he illustrates by a reference to the calculating machine, which for a million of times will produce numbers in regular series, and then for once produce a number of a different order. Thus the law of species that like shall beget like may hold good for an indefinite period, and then suddenly a new species be begotten. These theories and their authors have fallen into utter disrepute among scientific men, and have no other than a slight historical interest. Darwin. The new theory on this subject proposed by Mr. Charles Darwin has, for the time being, a stronger hold on the public mind. He stands in the first rank of naturalists, and is on all sides respected not only for his knowledge and his skill in observation and description, but for his frankness and fairness. His theory, however, is substantially the same with those already mentioned, inasmuch as he also accounts for the origin of all the varieties of plants and animals by the gradual operation of natural causes. In his work on the origin of species he says, "I believe that animals are descended from at most only 4 or 5 progenitors, and plants from an equal or lesser number." On the same page, 16, however, he goes much further, and says analogy would lead me one step further, namely, to the belief that all animals and plants are descended from some one prototype. And he adds that all the organic beings, which have ever lived on this earth, may be descended from some one primordial form. 17. The point of most importance in which Darwin differs from his predecessors is, that he starts with life, they with dead matter. They undertake to account for the origin of life by physical causes. Whereas he assumes the existence of living cells or germs. He does not go into the question of their origin. He assumes them to exist, which would seem of necessity to involve the assumption of a creator. The second important point of difference between the theories in question is, that those before mentioned account for the diversity of species by the inward power of development, a vis a tergo as it were, that is a struggle after improvement. Whereas Darwin refers the origin of species mainly to the laws of nature operating ab extra, killing off the weak or less perfect, and preserving the stronger or more perfect. The third point of difference, so far as the author of The Vestiges of Creation is concerned, is that the latter supposes new species to be formed suddenly, whereas Darwin holds that they arise by a slow process of very minute changes. They all agree, however, in the main point that all the infinite diversity is and marvelous organisms of plants and animals, from the lowest to the highest, are due to the operation of unintelligent physical causes. The Darwinian theory, therefore, includes the following principles. First, that like begets like. Or the law of heredity, according to which throughout the vegetable and animal world, the offspring is like the parent. Second, the law of variation. That is, that while in all that is essential the offspring is like the parent, it always differs more or less from its progenitor. These variations are sometimes deteriorations, sometimes indifferent, sometimes improvements. That is, such as enable the plant or animal more advantageously to exercise its functions. Third, that as plants and animals increase in the geometrical ratio, they tend to outrun enormously the means of support, and this of necessity gives rise to a continued and universal struggle for life. Fourth, in this struggle the fittest survive. That is, those individuals which have an accidental variation of structure which renders them superior to their fellows in the struggle for existence, survive, and transmit that peculiarity to their offspring. This is natural selection. That is, nature, without intelligence or purpose, selects the individuals best adapted to continue and to improve the race. It is by the operation of these few principles that in the course of countless ages all the diversified forms of vegetables and animals have been produced. It is interesting, says Darwin, to contemplate a tangled bank, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other, and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance which is almost implied by reproduction, variability from the indirect and direct action of the conditions of life, and from use and disuse. A ratio of increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life, and as a consequence to natural selection, entailing divergence of character and the extinction of less improved forms. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely, the production of the higher animals, directly follows. 18. Remarks on the Darwinian theory. First, it shocks the common sense of unsophisticated men to be told that the whale and the hummingbird, man and the mosquito, are derived from the same source. Not that the whale was developed out of the hummingbird, or man out of the mosquito, but that both are derived by a slow process of variations continued through countless millions of years. Such is the theory with its scientific feathers plucked off. No wonder that at its first promulgation it was received by the scientific world, not only with surprise, but also with indignation. 19. The theory has, indeed, survived this attack. Its essential harmony with the spirit of the age, the real learning of its author and advocates, have secured for it an influence which is widespread, and, for the time, imposing. A second remark is that the theory in question cannot be true, because it is founded on the assumption of an impossibility. It assumes that matter does the work of mind. This is an impossibility and an absurdity in the judgment of all men except materialists. And materialists are, ever have been, and ever must be, a mere handful among men, whether educated or uneducated. The doctrine of Darwin is that a primordial germ, with no inherent intelligence, develops, under purely natural influences, into all the infinite variety of vegetable and animal organisms, with all their complicated relations to each other and to the world around them. He not only asserts that all this is due to natural causes, and, moreover, that the lower impulses of vegetable life pass, by insensible gradations, into the instinct of animals and the higher intelligence of man, but he argues against the intervention of mind anywhere in the process. God, says Lamarck, created matter. God, says Darwin, created the unintelligent living cell. Both say that, after that first step, all else follows by natural law, without purpose and without design. No man can believe this, who cannot also believe that all the works of art, literature, and science in the world are the products of carbonic acid, water, and ammonia. The atheistic character of the theory. Thirdly, the system is thoroughly atheistic, and therefore cannot possibly stand. God has revealed His existence and His government of the world so clearly and so authoritatively, that any philosophical or scientific speculations inconsistent with those truths are like cobwebs in the track of a tornado. They offer no sensible resistance. The mere naturalist, the man devoted so exclusively to the study of nature as to believe in nothing but natural causes, is not able to understand the strength with which moral and religious convictions take hold of the minds of men. These convictions, however, are the strongest, the most ennobling, and the most dangerous for any class of men to disregard or ignore. In saying that this system is atheistic, it is not said that Mr. Darwin is an atheist. He expressly acknowledges the existence of God, and seems to feel the necessity of his existence to account for the origin of life, nor is it meant that everyone who adopts the theory does it in an atheistic sense. It has already been remarked that there is a theistic and an atheistic form of a nebular hypothesis as to the origin of the universe. So there may be a theistic interpretation of the Darwinian theory. Men who, as the Duke of Argyll, carry the reign of law into everything, affirming that even creation is by law, may hold, as he does, that God uses everywhere and constantly physical laws, to produce not only the ordinary operations of nature, but to give rise to things specifically new, and therefore to new species in the vegetable and animal worlds. Such species would thus be as truly due to the purpose and power of God as though they had been created by a word. Natural laws are said to be to God what the chisel and the brush are to the artist. Then God is as much the author of species as tile sculptor or painter is the author of the product of his skill. This is a theistic doctrine. That, however, is not Darwin's doctrine. His theory is that hundreds or thousands of millions of years ago God called a living germ, or living germs, into existence, and that since that time God has no more to do with the universe than if he did not exist. This is atheism to all intents and purposes, because it leaves the soul as entirely without God, without a father, helper, or ruler, as the doctrine of Epicurus or of Kant. Darwin, moreover, obliterates all the evidences of the being of God in the world. He refers to physical causes what all theists believe to be due to the operations of the divine mind. There is no more effectual way of getting rid of a truth than by rejecting the proofs on which it rests. Professor Huxley says that when he first read Darwin's book he regarded it as a death blow of teleology, that is of the doctrine of design and purpose in nature. 20 BCHNER, to whom the atheistical character of a book is a recommendation, says that Darwin's theory is the most thoroughly naturalistic that can be imagined, and far more atheistic than that of his despised Verfen and predecessor Lamarck, who admitted at least a general law of progress and development. Whereas, according to Darwin, the whole development is due to the gradual summation of innumerable minute and accidental natural operations. 21. Mr. Darwin argues against any divine intervention in the course of nature, and especially in the production of species. He says that the time is coming when the doctrine of special creation, that is, the doctrine that God made the plants and animals each after its kind, will be regarded as a curious illustration of the blindness of preconceived opinion. These authors, he adds, seem no more startled at a miraculous act of creation than at an ordinary birth. But do they really believe that at innumerable periods in the Earth's history certain elemental atoms have been commanded suddenly to flash into living tissues? This is precisely what Darwin professes to believe happened at the beginning. If it happened once, it is not absurd that it should happen often. Do they believe that at each supposed act of creation one individual or many were produced? Were all the infinitely numerous kinds of animals and plants created as eggs or seed, or as full-grown? And in the case of mammals, were they created bearing the false marks of nourishment from the mother's womb? 22. Mr. Wallace devotes the 8th chapter of his work on Natural Selection 23 to answering the objections urged by the Duke of Argyll to the Darwinian theory. He says, The point on which the Duke lays most stress is that proofs of mind everywhere meet us in nature and are more especially manifest wherever we find entrivance or yidi. He maintains that this indicates the constant supervision and direct interference of the Creator and cannot possibly be explained by the unassisted action of any combination of laws. Now, Mr. Darwin's work has for its main object to show that all the phenomena of living things, all their wonderful organs and complicated structures, their infinite variety of form, size, and color, their intricate and involved relations to each other, may have been produced by the action of a few general laws of the simplest kind, laws which are in most cases mere statements of admitted facts. 24 inches opposition to the doctrine that God applies general laws to produce effects which those laws are not in themselves capable of producing. He says, "I believe, on the contrary, that the universe is so constituted as to be self-regulating, that as long as it contains life, the forms under which that life is manifested have an inherent power of adjustment to each other and to surrounding nature, and that this adjustment necessarily leads to the greatest amount of variety and beauty and enjoyment, because it does depend on general laws, and not on a continual supervision and rearrangement of details." 25. Dr. Gray, 26, endeavors to vindicate Darwin's theory from the charge of atheism. His arguments, however, only go to prove that the doctrine of development, or derivation of species, may be held in a form consistent with theism. This no one denies. They do not prove that Mr. Darwin presents it in that form. Dr. Gray himself admits all that those who regard the Darwinian theory as atheistic contend for. 27. He says, "The proposition that things and events in nature were not designed to be so, if logically carried out, is doubtless tantamount to atheism." Again, 28. He says, "To us, a fortuitous cosmos is simply inconceivable. The alternative is a design cosmos. If Mr. Darwin believes that the events which he supposes to have occurred and the results we behold were undirected and undesigned, or if the physicist believes that the natural forces to which he refers phenomena are uncaused and undirected, no argument is needed to show that such belief is atheistic. No argument, after what has been said above, can be needed to show that Mr. Darwin does teach that natural causes are undirected, and that they act without design or reference to an end." This is not only explicitly and repeatedly asserted, but argued for, and the opposite view ridiculed and rejected. His book was hailed as the death blow of teleology. 29. Darwin, therefore, does teach precisely what Dr. Gray pronounces atheism. A man, it seems, may believe in God, and yet teach atheism. The antitheistic and materialistic character of this theory is still further shown by what Mr. Darwin says of our mental powers. In the distant future, he says, "I see open fields for far more important researches. Psychology will be based on a new foundation, that of the necessary acquirement of each mental power and capacity by gradation. Light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history." 30. Of this prediction he has himself attempted the verification in his recent work on the Descent of Man, in which he endeavors to prove that man is a developed ape. The Bible says man was created in the image of God. It is a mere hypothesis. A fourth remark on this theory is that it is a mere hypothesis, from its nature incapable of proof. It may take its place beside the nebular hypothesis as an ingenious method of explaining many of the phenomena of nature. We see around us, in the case of domestic animals, numerous varieties produced by the operations of natural causes. In the vegetable world, this diversity is still greater. Mr. Darwin's theory would account for all these facts. It accounts, moreover, for the unity of plan on which all animals of the same class or order are constructed. For the undeveloped organs and rudimentally in almost all classes of living creatures. For the different forms through which the embryo passes before it reaches maturity. These and many other phenomena may be accounted for on the assumption of the derivation of species. Admitting all this and much more, this does not amount to a proof of the hypothesis. These facts can be accounted for in other ways. While there are, as Darwin himself admits, many facts for which his theory will not account, let it be borne in mind what the theory is. It is not that all the species of any extant genus of plants or animals have been derived from a common stock. That all genera and classes of organized beings now living have been thus derived. But that all organisms from the earliest geological periods have, by a process requiring some 500 million years, been derived from one primordial germ. 31. Nor is this all. It is not only that material organisms have thus been derived by a process of gradation, but also that instincts, mental and moral powers, have been derived and attained by the same process. Nor is even this all. We are called upon to believe that all this has been brought about by the action of unintelligent physical causes. To our apprehension, there is nothing in the Hindu mythology and cosmology more incredible than this. It is hazarding little to say that such a hypothesis as this cannot be proved. Indeed, its advocates do not pretend to give proof. Mr. Wallace, as we have seen, says, Mr. Darwin's work has for its main object to show that all the phenomena of living things, all their wonderful organs and complicated structures, their infinite variety of form, size, and color, their intricate and involved relations to each other, may have been produced by the action of a few general laws of the simplest kind. May have been. There is no pretense that this account of the origin of species can be demonstrated. All that is claimed is that it is a possible solution. Christians must be very timid to be frightened by a mere may have been. Mr. Huxley says, after much consideration, and with assuredly no bias against Mr. Darwin's views, it is our clear conviction that, as the evidence stands, it is not absolutely proven that a group of animals, having all the characters exhibited by species and nature, has ever been originated by selection, whether artificial or natural. 32. In Fraser's Magazine for June and July, 1860, are two papers on the Darwinian theory, written by William Hopkins, F.R.S. In the number for July it is said, if we allow full weight to all our author's arguments in his chapter on hybridism, we only arrive at the conclusion that natural selection may possibly have produced changes of organization, which may have superinduced the sterility of species. And that, therefore, the above proposition may be true, though not a single positive fact be adduced in proof of it. And it must be recollected that this is no proposition of secondary importance, a mere turret, as it were, in our author's theoretical fabric, but the chief cornerstone which supports it. We confess that all the respect which we entertain for the author of these views has inspired us with no corresponding feeling towards this maybe philosophy, which is content to substitute the merely possible for the probable, and which, ignoring the responsibility of any approximation to rigorous demonstration in the establishment of its own theories, complacently assumes them to be right till they are rigorously proved to be wrong. When Newton, in former times, put forth his theory of gravitation, he did not call on philosophers to believe it, or else to show that it was wrong, but felt it incumbent on himself to prove that it was right. 33. Mr. Hopkins' review was written before Mr. Darwin had fully expressed his views as to the origin of man. He says, the great difficulty in any theory of development is the transition in passing up to man from the animals next beneath him, not to man considered merely as a physical organism, but to man as an intellectual and moral being. Lamarck and the author of the Aesthetisch have not hesitated to expose themselves to a charge of gross materialism in deriving mind from matter, and in making all its properties and operations depend on our physical organization. We believe that man has an immortal soul, and that the beasts of the field have not. If anyone deny this, we can have no common ground of argument with him. Now we would ask, at what point of his progressive improvement did man acquire the spiritual part of his being, endowed with the awful attribute of immortality? Was it an accidental variety, seized upon by the power of eternal selection, and made permanent? Is the step from the finite to the infinite to be regarded as one of the indefinitely small steps in man's continuous progress of development, and affected by the operation of ordinary natural causes? 34. The point now in hand, however, is that Mr. Darwin's theory is incapable of proof. From the nature of the case, what concerns the origin of things cannot be known except by a supernatural revelation. All else must be speculation and conjecture. And no man under the guidance of reason will renounce the teachings of a well-authenticated revelation, in obedience to human speculation, however ingenious. The uncertainty attending all philosophical or scientific theories as to the origin of things is sufficiently apparent from their number and inconsistencies. Science, as soon as she gets past the actual and the extant, is in the region of speculation, and is merged into philosophy, and is subject to all its hallucinations. Theories of the universe. Thus we have 1. The purely atheistic theory, which assumes that matter has existed forever, and that all the universe contains and reveals is due to material forces. 2. The theory which admits the creation of matter, but denies any further intervention of God in the world, and refers the origin of life to physical causes. This was the doctrine of Lamarck, and of the author of The Vestiges of Creation, and is the theory to which Professor Huxley, notwithstanding his denial of spontaneous generation in the existing state of things, seems strongly inclined in his address as President of the British Association for the Promotion of Science, delivered in September, 1870. He said, looking back through the prodigious vista of the past, "I find no record of the commencement of life, and therefore I am devoid of any means of forming a definite conclusion as to the conditions of its appearance." Belief, in the scientific sense of the word, is a serious matter, and needs strong foundations. To say, therefore, in the admitted absence of evidence, that I have any belief as to the mode in which the existing forms of life have originated, would be using words in a wrong sense. But expectation is permissible, where belief is not. And if it were given me to look beyond the abyss of genealogically recorded time to the still more remote period when the earth was passing through physical and chemical conditions which it can no more see again than a man may recall his infancy, I should expect to be a witness of the evolution of living protoplasm from not living matter. I should expect to see it appear under forms of great simplicity, endowed, like existing fungi, with the power of determining the formation of new protoplasm from such matters as ammonium carbonates, oxalates and tartrates, alkaline and earthy phosphates, and water, without the aid of light. 35. It had been well for the cause of truth, and well for hundreds who have been perverted by his writings, if M.R. Darwin had recognized this distinction between scientific belief needing strong foundations, and expectation founded, as Professor Huxley says in the following sentence, on analogical reasoning. In the paper already quoted in Fraser's Magazine, the writer says, in reference to Darwin, we would also further remind him that the philosophical naturalist must not only train the eye to observe accurately, but the mind to think logically. And the latter will often be found the harder task of the two. With respect to all but the exact sciences, it may be said that the highest mental faculty which they call upon us to exert is that by which we separate and appreciate justly the possible, the probable, and the demonstrable. 36. Darwin. 3. The third speculative view is that of Mr. Darwin and his associates, who admit not only the creation of matter, but of living matter, in the form of one or a few primordial germs from which, without any purpose or design, by the slow operation of unintelligent natural causes, and accidental variations, during untold ages, all the orders, classes, genera, species, and varieties of plants and animals, from the lowest to the highest, man included, have been formed. Teleology, and therefore, mind, or God, is expressly banished from the world. In arguing against the idea of God's controlling with design the operation of second causes, Mr. Darwin asks, did he ordain that the crop and tail feathers of the pigeon should vary, in order that the fancier might make his grotesque powder and fantail breeds? Did he cause the frame and mental qualities of the dog to vary in order that a breed might be formed of indomitable ferocity, with jaws fitted to pin down the bull for man's brutal sport? But, if we give up the principle in one case, if we do not admit that the variations of the primeval dog were intentionally guided, in order that the greyhound, for instance, that perfect image of symmetry and vigor, might be formed, no shadow of reason can be assigned for the belief that variations, alike in nature and the result of the same general laws, which have been the groundwork through natural selection of the formation or the most perfectly adapted animals in the world, man included, were intentionally and specially guided. However much we may wish it, we can hardly follow Professor Asa Gray in his belief that variation has been led along certain beneficial lines, like a stream long definite and useful lines of irrigation. 37 inches. This paragraph man is declared to be an unintended product of nature. J.J. Murphy. 4. Others again, unable to believe that unintelligent causes can produce effects indicating foresight and design, insist that there must be intelligence engaged in the production of such effects, but they place this intelligence in nature and not in God. This, as remarked above, is a revival of the old idea of a demiurgus or anima mundi. Mr. J.J. Murphy, in his work on habit and intelligence, says, "I believe that there is something in organic progress which mere natural selection among spontaneous variations will not account for. Finally, I believe this something is that organizing intelligence which guides the action of the inorganic forces and forms structures which neither natural selection nor any other unintelligent agency could form." 38. What he means by intelligence and where it resides we learn from the preface to the first volume of his book. The word intelligence, he says, scarcely needs definition, as I use it in its familiar sense. It will not be questioned by anyone that intelligence is found in none but living beings. But it is not so obvious that intelligence is an attribute of all living beings, and coextensive with life itself. When I speak of intelligence, however, I mean not only the conscious intelligence of the mind, but also the organizing intelligence which adapts the eye for seeing, the ear for hearing, and every other part of an organism for its work. The usual belief is that the organizing intelligence and the mental intelligence are two distinct intelligences. I have stated the reasons for my belief that they are not distinct, but are two separate manifestations of the same intelligence, which is coextensive with life, though it is for the most part unconscious, and only becomes conscious of itself in the brain of man. 39. 1. 5. Professor Owen, England's great naturalist, agrees with Darwin in two points. First, in the derivation or gradual evolution of species. And secondly, that this derivation is determined by the operation of natural causes. I have been led, he says, to recognize species as exemplifying the continuous operation of natural law, or secondary cause. And that, not only successively, but progressively. From the first embodiment of the vertebrate idea under its old ichthyic vestment until it became arrayed in the glorious garb of the human form. 40. He differs from Darwin in that he does not refer the origin of species to natural selection, that is to the law of the survival of the fittest of accidental variations, but to inherent or innate tendencies. Every species changes, in time, by virtue of inherent tendencies thereto. 41. And in the second place, he does not regard these changes as accidental variations, but as designed and carried out in virtue of an original plan. Species owe as little, he says, 42, to the accidental concurrence of environing circumstances as cosmos depends on a fortuitous concourse of atoms, a purpose of root of development and change, of correlation and interdependence, manifesting intelligent will, is as determinable in the succession of races as in the development and organization of the individual. Generations do not vary accidentally, in any and every direction, but in preordained, definite, and correlated courses. 43. The reign of law theory. 6. Still another view is that which demands intelligence to account for the wonders of organic life, and finds that intelligence in God, but repudiates the idea of the supernatural. That is, it does not admit that God ever works except through second causes or by the laws of nature. Those who adopt this view are willing to admit the derivation of species, and to concede that extant species were formed by the modifications of those which preceded them, but maintain that they were thus formed according to the purpose, and by the continued agency, of God. An agency ever operative in guiding the operation of natural law so that they accomplish the designs of God. The difference between this and Professor Owen's theory is that he does not seem to admit of this continued intelligent control of God and nature, but refers everything to the original, preordaining purpose or plan of the divine being. 7. Finally, without pretending to exhaust the speculations on the subject, we have what may be called the commonly received and scriptural doctrine. That doctrine teaches, 1. That the universe and all it contains owe their existence to the will and power of God. That matter is not eternal, nor is life self-originating. 2. God endowed matter with properties or forces, which he upholds, and in accordance with which he works in all the ordinary operations of his providence. That is, he uses them everywhere and constantly, as we use them in our narrow sphere. 3. That in the beginning he created, or caused to be, every distinct kind of plant and animal, and God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself, upon the earth," and it was so. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind, cattle, and creeping thing, and beast of the earth after his kind," and it was so. This is a scriptural account of the origin of species. According to this account, each species was specially created, not ex nihilo, nor without the intervention of secondary causes, but nevertheless originally, or not derived, evolved, or developed from pre-existing species. These distinct species, or kinds of plants and animals thus separately originated, are permanent. They never pass from one into the other. It is, however, to be remembered that species are of two kinds, as naturalists distinguish them, namely, natural and artificial. The former are those which have their foundation in nature, which had a distinct origin, and are capable of indefinite propagation. The latter are such distinctions as naturalists have made for their own convenience. Of course, it is not intended that every one of the so-called species of plants and animals is original and permanent, when the only distinction between one species and another may be the accidental shape of a leaf or color of a feather. It is only of such species as have their foundation in nature that originality and permanence are asserted. Artificial species, as they are called, are simply varieties. Fertility of offspring is the recognized criterion of sameness of species. If what has been just said be granted, then, if at any time since the original creation, new species have appeared on the earth, they owe their existence to the immediate intervention of God. Here then are at least seven different views as to the origin of species. How is it possible for science to decide between them? Science has to do with the facts and laws of nature. But here the question concerns the origin of such facts. Here, says Dr. Gray, proofs, in the proper sense of the word, are not to be had. We are beyond the region of demonstration, and have only probabilities to consider. 44 Christians have a right to protest against the array of probabilities against the clearer teachings of Scripture. It is not easy to estimate the evil that is done by eminent men throwing the weight of their authority on the side of unbelief, influenced by a mere balance of probabilities in one department, to the neglect of the most convincing proofs of a different kind. They treat, for example, the question of the unity of the human race, exclusively as a zoological question, and ignore the testimony of history, of language, and of Scripture. Thus they often decide against the Bible on evidence that would not determine an intelligent jury in a suit for 20 shillings. Admitted difficulties in the way of the Darwinian theory. One of the great excellences of Mr. Darwin is his candor. He acknowledges that there are grave objections against the doctrine which he endeavors to establish. He admits that if one species is derived by slow gradations from another, it would be natural to expect the intermediate steps, or connecting links, to be everywhere visible. But he acknowledges that such are not to be found, that during the whole of the historical period, species have remained unchanged. They are now precisely what they were thousands of years ago. There is not the slightest indication of anyone passing into another, or of a lower advancing towards a higher. This is admitted. The only answer to the difficulty thus presented is that the change of species is so slow a process that no indications can be reasonably expected in the few thousand years embraced within the limits of history. When it is further objected that geology presents the same difficulty, that the genera and species of fossil animals are just as distinct as those now living, that new species appear at certain epochs entirely different from those which preceded, that the most perfect specimens of these species often appear at the beginning of a geologic period and not toward its close. The answer is that the records of geology are too imperfect to give us full knowledge on the subject that innumerable intermediate and transitional forms may have passed away and left no trace of their existence. All this amounts to an admission that all history and all geology are against the theory. That they not only do not furnish any facts in its support, but that they do furnish facts which, so far as our knowledge extends, contradict it. In reference to these objections from geology, Mr. Darwin says, "I can answer these questions and objections only on the supposition that the geological record is far more imperfect than most geologists believe. The number of specimens in all our museums is absolutely as nothing compared with the countless generations of countless species which have certainly existed. 45 Nevertheless, the record, as far as it goes, is against the theory. With regard to the more serious objection that the theory assumes that matter does the work of mind, that design is accomplished without any designer, Mr. Darwin is equally candid. Nothing at first, he says, can appear more difficult to believe than that the more complex organs and instincts have been perfected, not by means superior to, though analogous with, human reason, but by the accumulation of innumerable slight variations, each good for the individual possessor. Nevertheless, this difficulty, though appearing to our imagination insuperably great, cannot be considered real, if we admit the following propositions, namely, that all parts of the organization and instincts offer at least individual differences, that there is a struggle for existence leading to the preservation of profitable deviations of structure or instinct, and, lastly, that gradations in the state of perfection of each organ may have existed, each good of its kind. 46. Again, he says, although the belief that an organ so perfect as the eye could have been formed by natural selection is more than enough to stagger anyone, yet in the case of any organ, if we know of a long series of gradations in complexity, each good for its possessor, then, under changing conditions of life, there is no logical impossibility in the acquirement of any conceivable degree of perfection through natural selection. 47 Mr. Darwin refuses to be staggered by that which he says is enough to stagger anyone. Give him a sufficient number of millions of years, and fortuitous complications may accomplish anything. If a rude piece of flint be found in deposits, it is declared to be the work of man, because it indicates design, while such an organ as the eye may be formed by natural selection acting blindly. This, Dr. Gray says in his apology, is, or would be, a strange contradiction. Sterility of hybrids. The immutability of species is stamped on the very face of nature what the letters of a book would be if all were thrown in confusion. The genera and species of plants and animals would be, if they were, as Darwin's theory assumes, in a state of constant variation, and that in every possible direction. All line marks would be obliterated, and the thoughts of God, as species have been called, would be obliterated from his works. To prevent this confusion of kind, it has been established as a law of nature that animals of different kinds cannot mingle and produce something different from either parent, to be again mingled and confused with other animals of a still different kind. In other words, it is a law of nature, and therefore a law of God, that hybrids should be sterile. This fact Mr. Darwin does not deny. Neither does he deny the weight of the argument derived from it against his theory. He only, as in the cases already mentioned, endeavors to account for the fact connecting links between species are missing. But they may have perished. Hybrids are sterile. But that may be accounted for in some other way without assuming that it was designed to secure the permanence of species. When a great fact in nature is found to secure a most important end in nature, it is fair to infer that it was designed to accomplish that end, and consequently that end is not to be overlooked or denied. Geographical distribution. Mr. Darwin is equally candid in reference to another objection to his doctrine. Turning to geographical distribution, he says, 48 The difficulties encountered on the theory of descent with modification are serious enough. All the individuals of the same species, and all the species of the same genus, or even higher group, must save descended from common parents. And therefore, in however distant and isolated parts of the world they may now be found, they must in the course of successive generations have traveled from some one point to all the others. When it is remembered that this is true of the mollusks and crustacea, animals whose power of locomotion is very limited, this almost universal distribution from one center would seem to be an impossibility. Darwin's answer to this is the same as to the difficulties already mentioned. He throws himself on the possibilities of unlimited duration. Nobody can tell what may have happened during the untold ages of the past. Looking to geographical distribution, he says, if we admit that there has been through the long course of ages much migration from one part of the world to another, owing to former climatal and geographical changes and to the many occasional and unknown means of dispersal, then we can understand, on the theory of descent with modification, most of the great leading facts in distribution. 49. Everyone must see how inconclusive is all such reasoning. If we admit that many unknown things may have happened in the boundless past, then we can understand most, but not all, of the facts which stand opposed to the theory of the derivation of species. The same remark may be made in reference to the constant appeal to the unknown effects of unlimited durations. The chief cause, says Mr. Darwin, of our natural unwillingness to admit that one species has given birth to other and distinct species, is that we are always slow in admitting any great change of which we do not see the steps. The mind cannot possibly grasp the full meaning of the term of even 10 million years. It cannot add up and perceive the full effects of many slight variations accumulated during an almost infinite number of generations. 50. If we say that the ape during the historic period extending over thousands of years has not made the slightest approximation towards becoming a man, we are told, ah, but you do not know what he will do in 10 millions of years. To which it is a sufficient reply to ask, how much is 10 million times nothing? Ordinary men reject this Darwinian theory with indignation as well as with decision, not only because it calls upon them to accept the possible as demonstrably true, but because it ascribes to blind, unintelligent causes the wonders of purpose and design which the world everywhere exhibits, and because it effectually banishes God from his works. To such men it is a satisfaction to know that the theory is rejected on scientific grounds by the great majority of scientific men. Mr. Darwin himself says, the several difficulties here discussed, namely that, though we find in our geological formations many links between the species which now exist and which formerly existed, we do not find infinitely numerous time transitional forms closely joining them all together. The sudden manner in which several whole groups of species first appear in our European formations. The almost entire absence, as at present known, of formations rich in fossils beneath the Cambrian strata, are all undoubtedly of the most serious nature. We see this in the fact that the most eminent paleontologists, namely, Gvir, Agassiz, Baron, Pictet, Falconer, E. Forbes, etc., and all our greatest geologists, as Lyell, Murchison, Sedgwick, etc., have unanimously, often vehemently, maintained the immutability of species. 51. In 1830 there was a prolonged discussion of the subject in the Académie des Sciences in Paris, Gvir taking the side of the permanence of species, and of creation and organization governed by final purpose, while Geoffroy St. Hilaire took the side of the derivation and mutability of species, and denied, as Professor Owen says, evidence of design, and protested against the deduction of a purpose. The decision was almost unanimously in favor of Gvir. And from 1830 to 1860 there was scarcely a voice raised in opposition to the doctrine which Gvir advocated. This, as B.C.H.N.E.R. thinks, was the triumph of empiricism, appealing to facts, over philosophy guided by a priori speculation. And Professor Agassiz, confessedly the first of living naturalists, thus closes his review of Darwin's book. Were the transmutation theory true, the geological record should exhibit an uninterrupted succession of types blending gradually into one another. The fact is that throughout all geological times each period is characterized by definite specific types, belonging to definite genera, and these to definite families, referable to definite orders, constituting definite classes and definite branches, built upon definite plans. Until the facts of nature are shown to have been mistaken by those who have collected them, and that they have a different meaning from that now generally assigned to them, I shall therefore consider the transmutation theory as a scientific mistake, untrue in its facts, unscientific in its method, and mischievous in its tendency. 52. Of species, then, are immutable, their existence must be due to the agency of God, mediate or immediate, and in either case so exercised as to make them answer a thought and purpose in the divine mind. And, more especially, man does not owe his origin to the gradual development of a lower form of irrational life, but to the energy of his maker in whose image he was created. Pangenesis. Mr. Darwin refers, in The Origin of Species, 53, to the hypothesis of pangenesis, which, he says, he had developed in another work. As this hypothesis is made subservient to the one under consideration, it serves to illustrate its nature and gives an insight into the character of the writer's mind. Mr. Maivart says that the hypothesis of pangenesis may be stated as follows: that each living organism is ultimately made up of an almost infinite number of minute particles, or organic atoms, termed animalcules, each of which has the power of reproducing its kind. Moreover, that these particles circulate freely about the organism which is made up of them, and are derived from all parts of all the organs of the less remote ancestors of each such organism during all the states and stages of such several ancestors' existence, and therefore of the several states of each of such ancestors' organs. That such a complete collection of gametules is aggregated in each ovum and spermatozoa and in most animals, and each part capable of reproducing by gemmation budding in the lowest animals and plants. Therefore, in many of such lower organisms, such a congeries of ancestral gametules must exist in every part of their bodies, since in them every part is capable of reproducing by gemmation. Mr. Darwin must evidently admit this, since he says, "T has often been said by naturalists that each cell of a plant has the actual or potential capacity of reproducing the whole plant. But it has this power only in virtue of containing gametules derived from every part." 54. These gametules are organic atoms. They are almost infinite in number. They are derived from all the organs of the less remote ancestors of the plant or animal. They are stored in every ovum or spermatozoon. They are capable of reproduction. But reproduction, as involving the control of physical causes to accomplish a purpose, is a work of intelligence. These inconceivably numerous and minute gametules are, therefore, the seats of intelligence. Surely this is not science. Any theory which needs the support of such a hypothesis must soon be abandoned. It would be far easier to believe in fairies forming every plant than in these gametules. Finally, it may be noticed that Mr. Wallace, although advocating the doctrine of natural selection, contends that it is not applicable to man, that it will not account for his original or present state, and that it is impossible, on Mr. Darwin's theory, to account for man's physical organization, for his mental powers, or for his moral nature. To this subject the 10th chapter of his work is devoted. Section 3. Antiquity of Man. Anthropologists are now, as we are told, pretty well agreed that man is not a recent introduction into the earth. All who have studied the question now admit that his antiquity is very great, and that, though we have to some extent ascertained the minimum of time during which he must have existed, we have made no approximation towards determining that far greater period during which he may have, and probably has, existed. We can with tolerable certainty affirm that man must have inhabited the earth 1,000 centuries ago, but we cannot assert that he positively did not exist, or that there is any good evidence against his having existed, for a period of 10,000 centuries. 55. On this it may be remarked, first, that it is a historical fact that nothing is less reliable than these calculations of time. A volume might be filled with examples of the mistakes of naturalists in this matter. The world has not forgotten the exultation of the enemies of the Bible when the number of successive layers of lava on the sides of Mount Etna was found to be so great as to require, as was said, thousands upon thousands of years for their present condition. All that has passed away. Mr. Lyell calculated that 220,000 years were necessary to account for changes now going on the coast of Sweden. Later geologists reduced the time to 1/10 of that estimate. A piece of pottery was discovered deeply buried under the deposits at the mouth of the Nile. It was confidently asserted that the deposit could not have been made during the historic period, until it was proved that the article in question was of Roman manufacture. Sober men of science, therefore, have no confidence in these calculations requiring thousands of centuries, or even millions of years, for the production of effects subsequent to the great geological epochs. The second remark in reference to this great antiquity claim the human race is that the reasons assigned for it are, in the judgment of the most eminent men of science, unsatisfactory. The facts urged to prove that men have lived for an indefinite number of ages on the earth are 1. The existence of villages built on piles, now submerged in lakes in Switzerland and in some other places, which, it is assumed, are of great antiquity. 2. The discovery of human remains in a fossil state in deposits to which geologists assign an age counted by tens, or hundreds, of thousands of years. 3. The discovery of utensils of different kinds made of flint, in connection with the remains of extinct animals. 4. The early separation of men into the distinct races in which they now exist. On this point, Sir Charles Lyell says naturalists have long felt that to render probable the received opinion that all the leading varieties of the human family have originally sprung from a single pair, a doctrine against which there appears to me to be no sound objection, a much greater lapse of time is required for the slow and gradual formation of races such as the Caucasian, Mongolian, and Negro than is embraced in any of the popular systems of chronology. The Caucasian and the Negro are distinctly marked in the Egyptian monuments to which an antiquity of 3,000 years is ascribed. We must, therefore, he argues, allow for a vast series of antecedent ages to account for the gradual formation of these distinct races. 56 inches addition to all these arguments, it is contended that monuments and records exist which prove the existence of man on the earth long before the period assigned to his creation in the Bible. Lake dwellings. In many of the lakes of Switzerland, piles have been discovered worn down to the surface of the mud, or projecting slightly above it, which once supported human habitations. These are so numerous as to render it evident that whole villages were thus sustained over the surface of the water. These villages, nearly all of them, are of unknown date, but the most ancient of them certainly belong to the Age of Stone, for hundreds of implements resembling those of the Danish shell mounds and peat mosses have been dredged up from the mud into which the piles were driven. Numerous bones of no less than 54 species of animals have been dug up from these localities, all of which, with one exception, are still living in Europe. The remains of several domesticated animals, as the ox, sheep, goat, and dog, are included in the number. 57. There is evidently in all this no proof of great antiquity. Even as late as during the last century, similar huts, supported on piles, were to be seen. All the animal remains found are of extant species. There is nothing to show that these lake dwellings were even as old as the time of the Romans. The fact relied upon is the absence of metal, and the presence of stone implements. Hence, it is inferred that these villages belong to the Stone Age. To this succeeded the Bronze Age, and to that the Age of Iron. Sir Charles Lyell informs us that the Swiss geologists, as represented by M. Monet, assign to the Bronze Age a date of between 3,000 and 4,000 years, and to the Stone Period an age of 5,000 to 7,000. 58. It is, however, a mere arbitrary speculation that there ever was a Stone Age. It is founded on the assumption that the original condition of man was one of barbarism, from which he elevated himself by slow degrees. During the first period of his progress, he used only implements of stone, then those of bronze, and then those of iron, and that thousands of years elapsed before the race passed from one of these stages of progress to another. Hence, if remains of men are found anywhere in connection with stone implements, they are referred to the Stone Age. According to this mode of reasoning, if in an Indian village flint arrowheads and hatchets should be found, the inference would be that the whole world was in barbarism when those implements were used, admitting that at the time the lake dwellings were inhabited, the people of Switzerland, and even all the people of Europe, were unacquainted with the use of the metals, that would not prove that civilization was not at its height in Egypt or India. Moreover, the assumption that the original state of man was one of barbarism is not only contrary to the Bible and to the convictions of the great body of the learned, but, as is believed, to the plainest historical facts. Fossil human remains. Much more weight in this discussion is attached to the discovery of human remains in the same localities and under the same circumstances with those of animals now extinct. From this it is inferred that man must have lived when those animals still inhabited the earth. These human remains are not found in any of the ancient fossiliferous rocks. The scriptural fact that man was the last of the living creatures which proceeded from the hand of God stands unimpeached by any scientific fact. A nearly perfect human skeleton was found embedded in a limestone rock on the island of Guadeloupe. That rock, however, is of modern origin and is still in process of formation. The age assigned to this fossil is only about 200 years. A fragment of conglomerate rock was obtained at the depth of 10 feet below the bed of the River Dove, in England, containing silver coins of the reign of Edward I. This shows that it does not require many years to form rocks and to bury them deeply under the surface. The remains on which stress is laid are found only in caverns and buried under deposits of peat or of earthy matter. Geologists seem to be agreed as to the fact that human bones have been found in certain caves in France, Belgium, and England, intimately associated with the remains of animals now living, and with those of a few of the extinct races. The fact being admitted, the question is, how is it to be accounted for? This juxtaposition is no certain proof of contemporaneousness. These caverns, once the resort of wild beasts, became to men places of concealment, of defense, of worship, or of sepulture, and, therefore, as Sir Charles Lyell himself admits, it is not on the evidence of such intermixtures that we ought readily to admit either the high antiquity of the human race, or the recent date of certain lost species of quadrupeds. 59. In immediate connection with the passage just referred to, Lyell suggests another method by which the remains of animals belonging to very different ages of the world might become mixed together. That is, open fissures which serve as natural pitfalls. He quotes the following account from Professor Sedgwick of a chasm of enormous but unknown depth, which is surrounded by grassy shelving banks, and many animals, tempted toward its brink, have fallen down and perished in it. The approach of cattle is now prevented by a strong lofty wall. But there can be no doubt that, during the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, great masses of bony breccia must have accumulated in the lower parts of the great fissure, which probably descends through the whole thickness of the scar limestone to the depth of perhaps 500 or 600 feet. To this Lyell adds, when any of these natural pitfalls happen to communicate with lines of subterranean caverns, the bones, earth, and breccia may sink by their own weight, or be washed into the vaults below. 60. There is a third way in which this intermingling of the bones of animals of different ages may be accounted for. With regard to the remarkable caverns in the province of Liège, Sir Charles Lyell says that Dr. Schmerling, the naturalist, by whom they had been carefully and laboriously examined, did not think they were dens of wild beasts, but that their organic and inorganic contents had been swept into them by streams communicating with the surface of the country. The bones, he suggested, may often have been rolled in the beds of such streams before they reached their underground destination. 61. It is clear, therefore, that no conclusive argument to prove that man was contemporary with certain extinct animals can be drawn from the fact that their remains have in some rare instances been found in the same localities. Human bones found deeply buried. Still less weight is to be attached to the fact that human bones have been found deeply buried in the earth. Everyone knows that great changes have been made in the earth's surface within the historic period. Such changes are produced sometimes by the slow operation of the causes which have buried the foundations of such ancient cities as Jerusalem and Rome far beneath the present surface of the ground. At other times they have been brought about by sudden catastrophes. It is not surprising that human remains should be found in peat bogs, if, as Sir Charles Lyell tells us, all the coins, axes, arms, and other utensils found in British and French mosses are Roman. So that a considerable portion of the peat in European peat bogs is evidently not more ancient than the age of Julius Caesar. 62. The data by which the rate of deposits is determined are so uncertain that no dependence can be placed upon them. Sir Charles Lyell says, the lowest estimate of the time required for the formation of the existing delta of the Mississippi is more than 100,000 years. 63. According to the careful examination made by gentlemen of the Coast Survey and other United States officers, the time during which the delta has been in progress is 4,400 years. 64. Since the memory of man, or since fishing huts have been built on the coasts of Sweden, there has been such a subsidence of the coast that a fishing hut having a rude fireplace within was struck in digging a canal at a depth of 60 feet. 65 at the earthquake in 1819 about the delta of the Indus, an area of 2,000 square miles became an inland sea, and the fort and village of Sindri sunk till the tops of the houses were just above the water. 5.5 miles from Sindri, parallel with the sunken area, a region was elevated 10 feet above the delta, 50 miles long and in some parts 10 broad. 66 While such changes, secular and paroxysmal, gradual and sudden, have been in operation for thousands of years, it is evident that the intermingling of the remains of recent with those of extinct races of animals furnishes no proof that the former were contemporaneous with the latter. Flint implements. Quite as much stress has been laid on the discovery of certain implements made of flint under deposits which, it is contended, are of such age as prove that man must have existed on the earth for ages before the time assigned in the Bible for his creation. To this argument the same answer is to be given. First, that the presence of the works of human art in such deposits is no proof that men were contemporaneous with such deposits. In view of the upheavals and displacements which all geologists admit are of frequent occurrence in the history of our globe. And secondly, the facts themselves are disputed, or differently interpreted by men of science of equal authority. This is especially true of the flint arrows, beads, and axes found in the Valley of the Somme in France. 67 Lyell is confident that the argument from them is conclusive. Later examinations, however, have led others to a different conclusion. This is a question for scientific men to decide among themselves, and which they alone are competent to decide. So long, however, as men of the highest rank as naturalists maintain that science knows of no facts inconsistent with the scriptural account of the origin of man, the friends of the Bible are under no obligation to depart from the generally received interpretation of the scriptures on the subject. Professor Gill, as all who know him or have heard his public lectures, are well aware, teaches that there are no known facts which may not be accounted for on the assumption that man has existed 7 or 8,000 years on this earth. It is well known also that this doctrine, until very recently, was universal among scientific men. Gvir was so convinced on this point that he could hardly be brought to look at what purported to be the fossil remains of man. This conviction on his part was not a prejudice, nor was it due to a reverence for the Bible. It was a scientific conviction founded on scientific evidence. The proofs from all sources of the recent origin of man were considered such as to preclude the possibility of his being contemporaneous with any of the extinct races of animals. And even those who were led to admit that point were in many cases disposed to regard the fact as proving not the antiquity of man, but the existence to a much later period than generally supposed, of animals now extinct. The occurrence of human relics with the bones of extinct animals does not seem to me, says Prestwich, to necessitate the carrying of man back in past time, so much as the bringing forward of the extinct animals toward our own time. 68 The fact that the monuments of human art cannot pretend to a higher antiquity than a few thousand years, renders it utterly incredible that man has existed on the earth hundreds of thousands or, as Darwin supposes, millions of years. Argument from the races of men and from ancient monuments. Another argument is founded on the assumption that the difference between the Caucasian, Mongolian, and Negro races, which is known to have been as distinctly marked 2 or 3,000 years before Christ as it is now, must have required countless ages to develop and establish. To this it is obvious to answer, first, that differences equally great have occurred in domestic animals within the historic period. Secondly, that marked varieties are not unfrequently produced suddenly, and, so to speak, accidentally. Thirdly, that these varieties of race are not the effect of the blind operation of physical causes, but by those causes as intelligently guided by God for the accomplishment of some wise purpose. Animals living in the Arctic regions are not only clothed in fur for their protection from the cold, but the color of their clothing changes with the season. So God fashions the different races of men in their peculiarities to suit them to the regions which they inhabit. Dr. Livingstone, the great African traveler, informs us that the Negro type, as it is popularly conceived of, occurs very rarely in Africa, and only in districts where great heat prevails in connection with great moisture. The tribes in the interior of that continent differ greatly, he says, both in hue and contour. The idea that it must have taken countless ages for men to rise from the lowest barbarism to the state of civilization indicated by the monuments of Egypt rests on no better assumption. The earliest state of man, instead of being his lowest, was in many respects his highest state. And our own experience as a nation shows that it does not require millenniums for a people to accomplish greater works than Egypt or India can boast. 200 years ago, this country was a wilderness from the Atlantic to the Pacific. What is it now? According to Bunsen, it would require 100,000 years to erect all these cities, and to build all these railroads and canals. It is further urged as a proof of the great antiquity of man that the monuments and monumental records of Egypt prove that a nation existed in the highest state of civilization at the time of, or immediately after, the flood. The chronology of the Bible, it is argued, and the chronology of Egypt are thus shown to be irreconcilable. In reference to this difficulty, it may be remarked that the calculations of Egyptologists are just as precarious, and in many stances just as extravagant as those of geologists. This is proved by their discrepancies. It may be said, however, that even the most moderate students of Egyptian antiquities assign a date to the reign of Menes and the building of the pyramids inconsistent with the chronology of the Bible. To this it may be replied that the chronology of the Bible is very uncertain. The data are for the most part facts incidentally stated. That is, not stated for the purposes of chronology. The views most generally adopted rest mainly on the authority of Archbishop Usher, who adopted the Hebrew text for his guide, and assumed that in the genealogical tables each name marked one generation. A large part, however, of biblical scholars adopt the Septuagint chronology in preference to the Hebrew. So that instead of 4,000 years from the creation to the birth of Christ, we have nearly 6,000 years. Besides, it is admitted that the usual method of calculation founded on the genealogical tables is very uncertain. The design of those tables is not to give the regular succession of births in a given line, but simply to mark the descent. This is just as well done if 3, 4, or more generations be omitted, as if the whole list were complete. That this is the plan on which these genealogical tables are constructed is an admitted fact. Thus in Genesis 46:18, after recording the sons of Zilpah, her grandsons and her great-grandsons, the writer adds, "These are the sons of Zilpah, and these she bare unto Jacob, even 16 souls." The same thing recurs in the case of Bilhah, verse 25, "He bare these unto Jacob, all the souls were 7. Compare, verses 15, 22. No one can pretend that the author of this register did not use the term understandingly of descendants beyond the first generation. In like manner, according to Matthew 1:11, Josias begat his grandson Jeconias, and verse 8, Joram begat his great-great-grandson Ozias. And in Genesis 10:15-18, Canaan, the grandson of Noah, is said to have begotten several whole nations, the Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite, the Hivite, etc., etc. Nothing can be plainer, therefore, than that in the usage of the Bible, to bear and O beget are used in a wide sense to indicate descent, without restricting this to the immediate offspring. 69. The extreme uncertainty attending all attempts to determine the chronology of the Bible is sufficiently evinced by the fact that 180 different calculations have been made by Jewish and Christian authors of the length of the period between Adam and Christ. The longest of these make it 6,984, and the shortest 3,483 years. Under these circumstances, it is very clear that the friends of the Bible have no occasion for uneasiness. If the facts of science or of history should ultimately make it necessary to admit that 8 or 10,000 years have elapsed since the creation of man, there is nothing in the Bible in the way of such concession. The scriptures do not teach us how long men have existed on the earth. Their tables of genealogy were intended to prove that Christ was the son of David and of the seed of Abraham, and not how many years had elapsed between the creation and the advent. 70.